right here, right now. Every day, CIUT 89.5, the sound of your city. Toronto.
Good morning. Welcome to the Taylor Report. CIUT 89.5 FM in Toronto. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. Have an important matter to talk about today. The world knows there's a terrible war of aggression being waged by Israel and the United States against Iran, bypassing United Nations, international law, etc. Our guest is Mona Ghassani, and she's president of the Iranian-Canadian Congress. Good morning, Mona.
Good morning, Phil. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, we're really glad to be talking to you. Well, first of all, tell us, what is the Iranian-Canadian Congress?
Sure. The Iranian-Canadian Congress is a non-profit, non-partisan, and non-religious organization established in 2007 to represent the interests of Iranian-Canadians and encourage their participation in Canadian society.
Mm-hmm. Your organization, like all Iranian-Canadians, it must be under great stress at the moment. There are many issues. your organization has issued statements, and you've spoken, of course, on radio, television, and I believe you were at an event on the weekend. What is the Iranian-Canadian Association saying about what is taking place between Iran, Israel, and the United States?
Yes. Well, we absolutely condemn the attacks that were initiated by Israel and the United States on Iran. We believe in the sovereignty and self-determination of peoples and our nation, Iran, as we believe it must remain under the control of the Iranian people, and we are concerned that were those attacks to succeed in bringing down the current government, that would cause a power vacuum that would be very, very damaging to the people and the region. And unfortunately, these attacks have begun with on the first day, killing over 170 children in a single attack on a school mm-hmm. in the southern town of Minab, and this was a very tragic incident.
Yeah, and, by the way, can I ask you about that? I saw that some. I think it was it might have been. Doctors Without Borders or Red Crescent, Red Cross, some spokesman pointed out that it was not just one attack on that school. It was two.
Yes. So there were two bombs that hit the school. When I said single attack, I meant just the single location, and not when I said 170 victims. There's more than that. Victims are in the thousands, but just this particular location. They call it a double tap attack. So unfortunately, it causes a greater number of victims because sometimes people come to help or some people are surviving the first hit.
It's a tactic. It's a brutal, vicious, uncivilized tactic to do that.
Yes.
Am I right?
Absolutely. And of course, it's been condemned by different organizations across the world, including UNESCO, and it's a war crime. And it was according to what I understand from the satellite imagery, they should be able to tell that it's a school. It would seem intentional, but of course, they're not going to admit that. But we understand that it was a U.S. Tomahawk missile that were responsible for that strike.
It seems to me a striking feature of what is happening is that there is a kind of bloodlust. The Trump administration is distinct from previous perhaps somewhat, by the relish with which they do outrageous things, and the Western so-called civilized world remains quiet. I mean, starting with the circumstances, there was talks going on in Oman, and we were being told that they were going to be continuing, and then this happened. Can you talk about that?
Yes, well, we saw the same thing back in June. Iran was at talks with the U.S. at the time that Israel started their attacks, and then it was followed by the attacks from the Trump administration on the nuclear facilities. And we, yes, absolutely, the Trump administration is unusually blunt and clear about their intentions in a way that we haven't seen in past U.S. administrations. It feels like they don't even bother to make up excuses. You know, often there's a lot of propaganda in the run-up to these kinds of attacks, as we saw back with the Bush administration. There was an effort to make the U.S. population rally behind the attacks first on Afghanistan and then Iraq, this war on terror narrative, of course, after the September 11 attacks. And, you know, I think that at that time, people, because of what had happened in the U.S., they were more supportive of the attacks. But the percentages of support from the civilian population in the U.S. is much lower now. Around 20 to 30%, which is very, very low. So they haven't even bothered to get approval from their own population, and they, of course, attacked without any approval from UN or you know, as Mark Carney has stated, that they did not consult with Canada, but as an ally. But at the same time, he has not condemned the attacks. So, as you said earlier, they don't receive international condemnation.
That is a striking feature. The Carney has taken two or three kind of positions, moving around a little bit, because I think he understands the Canadian people are very worried about President Trump, not only because of this war, but because of the way the American leadership talks about the sovereign country of Canada, referring to Mr. Carney as a governor, that kind of thing. The policy of assassination is another that strikes me. Is it, of course, for most people, I suppose they pick up the paper or start the day's news and it begins with these events. But the U.S. has been, and Israel, definitely, have been assassinating Iranians over the years. Mr. Soleimani is, of course, the best known, I suppose. But could you talk about that phenomenon? That, again, because people think, oh, well, the war began with some kind of decision now by one, either the U.S. or Iran. But we've been living with a kind of war where scientists and academics, others have been killed in Iran with hardly any publicity in the West. Could you talk about what that is, that phenomena?
Yes, sure. I said in a speech I did at Al-Quds Day yesterday in Montreal that this is not the beginning of the war, that Iran has been under sanction for many years by the United States, which is kind of economic warfare, which affects primarily common people, who, and the tactic and the expectation is that the people will be so frustrated with their economic conditions that they will rebel against the government, which we have seen. But also these assassinations, as we saw Donald Trump in his first administration assassinated General Soleimani, and that is an act of war. And at that time, we were concerned that this war might happen. It took a bit longer. I think maybe at the time, they took a little bit more strategic and just to, thinking and took it as a win. But now we the escalation has been so strong because Iran always responded quite moderately, running up to the June attacks on Iran, what we call the 12-day war. There were attacks from Israel on multiple occasions. They were assassinating, of course, various figures in the axis of resistance, but also Iranian leaders, and have multiple on multiple occasions assassinated Iranian scientists, nuclear scientists. And so this has been kind of a long-running tactic, but I think they have underestimated Iran's strength in that they thought, Donald Trump thought that by hitting the supreme leader that the government would collapse, and that's not what has happened. So I think they had a name for it, like hitting the head of the snake or Hydra, something like that.
I'm afraid it might be from the cowboy movies where they used to say, shoot the one with the most feathers. And that was the answer to every question. Was it, you know, just knock off the leader. And let's talk about that, the fact that this, and your organization, Iranian-Canadian Congress, and that, by the way, people can go to icccongress.ca for the statements by the Congress, which are very important, very helpful. We need a proper framing or context to understand all these matters. Immediately, the media here, with the attack and assassination, spoke of the iron grip, was the term they used, the iron grip of the Ayatollah Khamenei. And yet, and no discussion of the fact that there is a parliament, I think it's called the Majlis, is it? And there are parties there. And as a matter of fact, the Western world gets very interested, fascinated by the elections. But suddenly, they now say, he was a dictator with an iron grip. Could you talk about what kind of political culture there is there that is not being discussed?
Yes, absolutely. The Iranian government is, as I understand it, modeled after French government or Western governments that have a parliament, that have various bodies of governance. And then there's some additional twists with the Islamic, the idea that Khomeini had, that there would be the Islamic leadership that would oversee everything to ensure that things were happening in accordance with the tenets of Islam. And this was part of a return back to the source that came after the revolution in 1979. People in Iran felt that they were being imposed upon by this kind of idea of secularization and westernization and, you know, under the monarchy. And this is the kind of government that came about, which is quite unique. But it, of course, includes the elected bodies. The supreme leader is selected by an elected body of the council of experts, they call them, and has a governance over certain aspects, and the president has governance over other aspects. And I think that actually what we have seen with that assassination is that it's quite a good system, because the president was still alive and, the country was still able to function. People are very, people participate in elections at much higher percentages, I think, than in some Western countries. And the candidates, not only are there parties, but often there are independent candidates who are able to achieve, win the elections, because there's not the same party system as they have in the U.S., which has
I remember that the Western world was somewhat shocked that following the death of the previous president in a helicopter accident, the Constitution was followed. Within 2 months, an election was held, and all the Western commentators were shocked because they said, well, my goodness, the moderate, they called him. I have no idea what they're basing this on. But the moderate won when we thought the hardliner was going to take over. So they were covering it like it actually was what it was, an honest contest of some type where different points of view were put in, before the Iranian people, and they made their choice. But then they flipped the page, and suddenly it's a one-man iron grip dictatorship. I mean, where I'm disappointed is in the Western world is, don't you remember when you were happily reporting that the moderate had won? And you forget that there was you ignore the fact that an actual democratic process took place. No democracy is perfect. I'm not saying that it's exactly, satisfies everybody. But these are real contests, and it's a real parliament. The current situation, I would like to ask you about the international response. What should be being done by the United Nations, maybe the United States Congress, and a country like Canada in response to this crisis?
Yes, that's, as you said earlier, our Prime Minister Mark Carney has taken different stances on the United States, and it seems to depend on the context when he was speaking at Davos. About middle powers needing to, take a new path and construct a new, that he was talking about the old world order not being what it claimed to be. And some people were hopeful with that speech, and we would hope that he would apply those principles in this case and apply, a just form of international law in that, judging the aggressors according to the fact that they are aggressive, and not simply going along with this, long-standing allyship of, Canada with the U.S. Unfortunately, it seems that a lot of the time we just walk in lockstep with them, and I would hope that he would follow the example of Chrétien. And of course, Chrétien refused to join the war in Iraq, and Carney, it seems, perhaps in response to our organization and many organizations had email campaigns to ask our Prime Minister to rescind his original comments of supporting for the U.S. So it seems that maybe in response to some of that, he said that Canada will not enter the war. Mm-hmm. But we would hope that he would actually apply standards.
I wonder about the extension of it. The Carney government and the British government, it looks like there's a type of back channel conspiring going on, because they're saying, oh, well, we're not involved, and we're not attacking. However, we may and are prepared to go to provide assistance to states in the region, which seems to me like a sneaky way to get into a war. Because if some of these, and this is a touchy issue, and it ought to be rather clear that states that bring in military, U.S. military bases, if they permit their state to be used to attack a sovereign country, a member of the United Nations, have to understand that the right of defense, which is often talked about here as a sacred thing, the right of defense is there for Iran, because they have to defend against the military, foreign military. Doesn't matter where they put their base. If it's attacking them, they have a right to defend, right?
Yes. So a couple of things. First, I want to go back to what you said about how it seems like a sneaky way to get in the war. Yes, I would actually still be concerned, because we know that with Palestine, people were asking that the Canadian government stop sending weapons and weapons parts, and they made statements to the effect that I think Minister Anand had made statements to the effect that actually there were no parts being sent, that the channels through the U.S. And it was found that actually no, that was not the case. They were still sending parts for the manufacture of weapons through the U.S. That were sent to Israel. So I think it's possible that Canada would be doing this as well in this case, and we have to push back and ensure that it is not the case and demand transparency on such matters. At the same time, yes, there's this idea that Iran has attacked in response to the attacks on Iranian land, that Iran has responded by attacking military bases in the Gulf nations, and there's this idea that's being pushed that Iran is wrong to do so. Well, where else can Iran respond? It's, those bases are the ones that are being used to for these attacks. So it's asymmetric warfare, and the U.S. is far away. Iran cannot reach the U.S. And even these claims that they had made that, we have to launch a preemptive attack on Iran because it's endangering our nation, the U.S. And, I mean, this was not the case. And quite unfortunate, the turn of events and the way the framing puts the blame on Iran, which was the
We're speaking to Mona Ghassani, and the president of the Iranian Canadian Congress, and it's you can go to ICCCongress.ca. We should probably tell, it's important for the listeners to know, remember something about this. The issue allegedly is the possible production by the Islamic Republic development of a nuclear weapon. Now, they've been attacked by two countries who have nuclear weapons. One is a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, I think, the United States, although they don't behave like it, but at any rate. And then there is Israel, which is not a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, yet is widely known and understood to have nuclear weapons. Iran has been has a capacity, is trying to develop the capacity to have to develop a nuclear power for source of energy. If, correct me if I'm wrong, is established by the Shah of Iran many years ago, and they've submitted to inspection. They've been part of in negotiations in which they're the one party which the maximum information exists about their nuclear energy. Is that right? Could you talk about what this issue is, which has permitted these two nuclear powers to attack one that can prove that it's not?
Yes, so under the Obama administration and in Iran when Rouhani was president, there was that agreement, as you stated, the JCPOA, and that allowed for increased inspections. Iran was already following, as you said, Iran was a member of the NPT. They allowed for, you know, quite more than usual, the usual inspections under this agreement in order to lighten some of the sanctions that they were placed under. And what President Trump did when he entered the office is he immediately canceled this agreement. So it was not Iran that stopped following the agreement. It was the president of the U.S. Mm-hmm. And it's quite twisted because of course, Iran, they are developing nuclear energy, and there's always been this pushback from Netanyahu specifically. There's always this idea that Iran is so close to a nuclear bomb,
yes,
which he has claimed over 30 years of his administration. And now, you know, he's saying that he got his wish to finally get the Americans on board to attack Iran, because of course the Israel by itself could not, withstand a war, a full-on war. That's why they go with the assassination tactic. And then also now they have assassinated the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, who had issued a fatwa against the acquisition of nuclear weapons. Because, you know, as much as the U.S. and war hawks like to trumpet that, Iran has, some terrible people in the administration. They are just, they hate freedom. I don't know what else they say, but...
Yes.
Actually, he was, reasonable in this matter, in the sense that he considered it, a horrible thing.
Weapons of mass destruction. By the way, it's not only atomic, it's chemical. And the Islamic Republic actually was a victim of a chemical attack.
Yes.
In the 8-year war waged against them, starting in 79, I think, or 80, chemical weapons were used against them, and they did not themselves respond with chemical weapons.
That's my understanding as well.
It's quite a remarkable situation that it's really a matter of rhetoric and propaganda winning out over facts. They engaged with the International Agency for Atomic Energy. I believe it's accurate. They opened themselves, I recall, to inspections. And I don't believe the International Atomic Energy Agency has ever inspected the United States. They definitely had not ever checked on Israel. They would never be permitted to do so. And yet we're in this war where the alleged threat comes from the one that's not armed. Bizarre.
Yes, absolutely. And they have, also, as I said before, attacked, killed nuclear scientists, assassinated them, and they have also, you perhaps have heard of the Stuxnet worm that they used to attack the centrifuges in Iran some years ago. And then, back in the 12-day war, I think Trump claimed that he had completely destroyed the nuclear facilities. And then always they come back to this nuclear threat. Mm-hmm. So it's odd. It's unfortunate. And, many people now think Iran should have developed a nuclear weapon because of the deterrent factor.
Yeah, there's certainly states in the region, India and Pakistan, have these weapons. Incidentally, by the way, it hasn't prevented them from fighting each other. There's some sort of fetish or superstition almost about these weapons and what they can do or not do in terms of solving issues between states. I think people are deluding themselves as to the significance. It's a horrible weapon, but it doesn't guarantee peace at all. We're speaking to Mona Ghassani, President of the Iranian Canadian Congress. I'm very pleased she could take the time to talk to us. You issued a statement on Women's Day. I hope people will read that. It's at icccongress.ca. There's a real misunderstanding, again, about Iranian culture at this point in history and the role of women. And your statement takes up the status of women in the arts and science and sports. By the way, we have, of course, a celebrated story at the moment, the situation in Australia with the Iranian women's team. Unfortunately for them, got caught in what used to be called a Cold War crisis, where people were trying to, it seems to me, were trying to prevent them from returning home. But let's just talk about the fact that they have a very successful program and they participate in international sports. But I think science would be the one I would, from what I've read over the years and observed, is where there's been tremendous advances. If I'm right, I'll let you explain that about the situation of women in science in Iran.
Yes, Iranian women are highly educated. I think the percentages have exceeded the men's rates of graduation from universities, and that's not really spoken about so much in the West. But
they win prizes, and no one pays any attention. They win. There's been no—I don't know if it's a Nobel Prize, but I know that it's in mathematics and chemistry. In recent years, Iranian women have been recognized as the best.
Yes, absolutely. So and they participate in all walks of life and all careers and as you mentioned, sports, sciences, politics. There's just maybe perhaps some people are against the hijab, and this is what gets highlighted in the Western media, right? It's always hijab, and
yes.
It's not even in the case anymore. That 50% of women, just if you go visit Tehran, you see that half of the women are not wearing hijab. So. Yeah. I think Iranian women are quite a powerful force, and if allowed to do so, they may continue to thrive. And these kinds of personal rights about personal dress and expression too, as well, can easily be achieved. If Iran were left alone, these things would happen in the natural course of things. And it's, Iran, as I said, the rates of education are very high, but it's a huge difference from pre-revolution to now. So from 1979 to today, it's just about a generation or two just a generation ago, my mother's generation, many women were getting married at 13 or 15, and that's no longer the case. They're getting married at, in their 30s. So,
yes.
That's a huge shift in the education rates and the achievements in terms of careers. I'm sure that we will see a positive change in terms of women's rights in Iran as well. And the framing that is put in the West, unfortunately, is not quite accurate. And in comparison to a lot of neighboring countries, Iranian women are faring much better.
Yeah, and by the way, that's how it should be understood, right? You measure a country against its own record, first of all, and then you look at it in relation to the neighboring cultures, which are similar or a long-standing relationship. I would assume Iran is way ahead of the Qatar, Saudi Arabia, certainly Afghanistan, Turkey. Turkey might be a competitor, but I doubt it. In terms of the representation of women, there are women in the Majlis, right?
Yes, absolutely, in the parliament. Yes.
And they also, are, of course, are represented in the diplomatic corps. And to my mind, so much danger has been created by simply smearing that sovereign country without any examination of the. They simply go by stereotypes. And so they've created a stereotype.
And it's according to what the Western powers, the U.S., they look at their interests, and the media follows that.
Right.
And as you said before, the narrative seems to shift at different points in time. And when gearing up towards the war, they emphasize those aspects that are deemed negative at their that audiences will be perhaps affected by. So that's exactly it.
Mm-hmm. Now it's Mona Ghassani, and she's president of the Iranian Canadian Congress. I know that you have had, and I've got a sort of a 4-point position taken by your organization. Of course, calling for the withdrawal of support for the strikes against the sovereign country. But your second point really seems to me very important for Canadians. You call for the publishing of UN Charter language, saying that the same standards should apply to the belligerents. I'll make it positive. Canadians would really benefit from being reminded of what, when people talk about about international law and values, they need to see the actual language. I noticed that Globe and Mail over the weekend actually, and the reason I think this is an important question, is that Globe and Mail basically said, throw it out. We don't care what the language says. So talk about that, the UN Charter language, and why you emphasize that.
Yes, well, of course, according to the UN Charter, I believe it's Article 51, Iran has the right to respond in defense, and it is exactly what it has done. And and my understanding, whenever I have followed the news, all of the attacks in the past, ping pong game before the June 12 day war, were always how do we call it, proportionate.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes, proportionate.
And so I think that if we look objectively, we and use the same standards, we come to a different conclusion than what is being put out by the Prime Minister's office. So we would like to see, the standards being applied.
Yeah, the UN was established on the corpse of Nazism, and it said that states would be, no matter whether they were big or small or what their culture, whatever their politics, would be represented as equals.
Mm-hmm.
What we seem to be getting a new ideology, which people, where it's being thrown aside, these principles, but there's no way there will be peace. There's no way that we can progress unless there's going to be minimal respect for sovereign countries, so that we can have an agreement. I think one of the things you call for is support for the International Agency for Atomic Energy verification. But I hate to say this, or maybe I don't hate to say, I'm glad to say, why don't this, in order for this to really work, it should be mutual. That is, if they're going to talk about Iran's nuclear capacity or whatever development and to guarantee that there will be no nuclear weapons, then we would have to inspect Israel as well as Iran. I don't understand why Iran would say, sure, inspect me, but don't inspect do not inspect the man who attacked me.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I've seen many, you know, people that just thinking that, you know, why is Iran being so, you know, moderate in going ahead with these negotiations and every time falling for the same trap? Because Iran is behaving as if those laws applied equally, but is being treated unequally. So I think that from a foreign policy perspective, from Iran, you know, that should protect them. Mm-hmm. And I think it's not incorrect. It will at least, you know, for anyone paying attention, we know what's going on. But unfortunately, they're not treated as equals in the fair manner. And that's part of why we have continually asked the Canadian government to renew diplomatic ties with Iran, instead of the current policy, which has been to continually isolate Iran with increasing sanctions, and you know, including naming the IRGC forces, which is part of the Iranian military forces, as a terrorist group, which is quite an unusual thing. And, you know, we have campaigned against it, partly because it affects ordinary people when they migrate to Canada, because the Iran requires military volunteer military service by all men. So, you know, it automatically puts a trigger on them, in a, not a trigger, but kind of, you know, causes problems when they are going through the immigration process or traveling to the U.S. So, you know, even individuals are not quite treated fairly when they come from Iran. Mm-hmm. And, for example, the closing of the embassies means that I cannot vote in the Iranian elections. So it's actually working against those democratic processes that exist in Iran and isolating Iran, treating it as, you know, a pariah state of some sort. And also there's the propaganda in the media that occurs around that. And there are, unfortunately, individuals within the Iranian diaspora who take advantage of those narratives to push their own, you know, either political gain.
To control the narrative, right?
I mean, yes, exactly.
And I wonder if Canadians remember that in 2015, when the Liberal government was elected, replacing Harper, they were promising that they were going to reopen the embassy and establish improved relations with Iran, also with China and some other countries. And then but all that was thrown overboard. But the people voted for the party that said that that's what they were going to do. But then they, unfortunately, it became a kind of a sad joke because they didn't do it.
Yes, that's unfortunate. Of course, our organization continues to push for this regardless. And, it, you know, it makes life difficult for ordinary people. Just, you know, sometimes if I need to travel to Iran, if I need to update my documents once in a while, my passport expires, I have to go through the United States. Ironically, they don't have any Iranian embassy there, but the Pakistani embassy has agreed to allow that. And I had sent my documents on a couple of occasions, and the envelope came back open. So I didn't feel safe. I felt like my documents were being inspected.
I think you can assume that, yes.
just because I was, born in Iran. And I feel that, Canada has a less openly aggressive policy towards Iran, and I would feel more comfortable to have my documents processed here. But for whatever reason, they
it sounds like a case of Canada needing to fight for its own integrity as a state, which, by the way, I think every Canadian shares with you that concern, because the way we are spoken of as second rate, as vulnerable by the greatest power on earth, people want their government to stand up. And the language about middle power so far hasn't panned out, but that is what people are looking for, is we want our own identity, and we want sufficient self-respect that we determine for ourselves what the policy should be. We don't go to Washington and say, oh, yes, you're right, even though you treat us rather poorly. The work of the Iranian-Canadian Congress to me is very, very important. And again, it's iccongress.ca. There's excellent, well thought-out positions. And it's very clear, by the way, and we should underline, there's this idea that you're on one side or the other, but what you're saying about both the Islamic Republic itself, but also, of course, the diaspora, there are many points of view. And there's this attempt to make it turn it into just a simple-minded thing of Shah versus the revolution, or et cetera. But actually, you have quite a diversity of opinion. But everybody's concerned not to have this war, right?
Yes. Unfortunately, there are those who are pro-war with very loud voices. Who I think that. Unfortunately, there is a bit of a turn in the media that are, once the war started, featuring those voices is a little bit less prominent. In the last few articles that I was interviewed for, they started with the anti-war voices, which is a good, positive development. But yes, our own organization, we have multiple points of view, and it's definitely more nuanced than sort of the black and white representation. There's people with religious beliefs, people with secular beliefs, but who all are united against war on Iran, our homeland, our country where of origin, where we have family, and this narrative that I don't think they're even touting that anymore. But at the beginning, they were touting this, especially Netanyahu, that we are with the Iranian people. They are only with the Iranian people when they think that the Iranians will overthrow their government. Otherwise, they throw bombs on them, including innocent children. And I think this narrative is hopefully going to break a little bit as people become aware of what's actually happening. I mentioned that there were civilian casualties, not even casualties. It would seem that they are being targeted. But there's also, medical, hospitals, medical institutions, and medical infrastructure targeted, different kinds of civilian infrastructure targeted, and cultural sites, cultural heritage sites. Despite, some of those being protected by UNESCO recognition.
Yes. That's a very troubling thing, yes.
Yes, because you can never get that back. It's thousands of years of history. So And unfortunately, you know, there was and continues to be a push by the monarchists, which even that, you know, the idea of monarchists in this day and age to me is a little bit laughable. Mm-hmm. But the monarchists who are trying to get this Reza Pahlavi, son of the former Shah, in power, they are very loud, very belligerent, and they try to push their narrative by force down the throats of people, you know, by intimidating anti-war voices. And by, I heard that in Toronto there was an individual who got beat by them. There were two arrests made. The Toronto Police Department put out a statement. They were, in both cases, they had physically attacked people with Iranian flags in the rally on Saturday, I believe it was. And these are the people, you know, and you know, when they were demanding, you know, change and regime change, these are the type of people we are dealing with. I don't think that would be any kind of democracy. So because I have seen some people saying that this Reza Shah will be a democratic replacement, or allowing for a democratic transition. I don't think that would be the case.
It's the old solution. It was the previous solution. They did it. Kermit Roosevelt did it to put the Shah in power.
The same as 1953.
Same show. They haven't even changed the cast. Well, we are so grateful that you're generous with your time. This is President of the Iranian Canadian Congress, Mona Ghassani, and it's the iccongress.ca.
Let me just correct you. There's two C's. So IC Congress, one for Canadian and one for Congress.
Thank you for doing that. ICC, I think, would take you off to an international court. Mona, we're very grateful. You're very articulate, and you were very generous with your time. We look forward to talking to you again, because this crisis, I'm afraid, is going to go on for some period.
Well, as long as we can get the word out there against the war, I would be happy to.
Free speech counts, doesn't it? Thank you.
Thank you so much for your time.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.